All right, now, last week, where we left off was roughly around the midpoint of the discussion of capital accumulation. We started by making a connection between capital accumulation and the productivity of labor, and we already knew that real wages depend on the productivity of labor, and we saw that the productivity of labor itself depends on the supply of capital goods per worker, which means real wages depend on the supply of capital goods per worker. And then we began to investigate the question of what underlies capital accumulation. That's a critical question. The entire standard of living of a country depends on its ability to accumulate capital. A progressing economy is one in which the supply of capital goods per capita increases. A stationary economy is one in which the supply of capital goods per worker remains unchanged. A retrogressing economy is one in which the supply of capital goods per worker is going down. And we identified at least one of the essential requirements of capital accumulation, and this is a sufficient relative production of capital goods, a production of capital goods to the point of surpassing the capital goods used up in production. When we produce anything, capital goods that already exist are being used up or worn out. And in order to maintain the supply of capital goods, it's essential that we produce at least as many capital goods as we use up. To have capital accumulation, we need to produce more capital goods than we use up. Now, what determines the extent to which an economy produces capital goods is the relative demand for capital goods. At any given time, we have a certain existing supply of capital goods. We have a certain supply of labor. Between the two, they have a certain productive potential. The existing capital goods, together with the existing supply of labor, can be used to produce capital goods and consumers' goods. It could be used to produce more of one at the expense of less of the other. And to make it possible to carry on our discussion in terms of simple quantitative numbers, we made the assumption that if we did nothing but produce capital goods, we could produce a quantity that we would call 2K of capital goods. And meanwhile, we would use up the existing quantity, 1K. We assume that all of the capital goods in existence at the beginning of a year are used up in that very same year for the purposes of simplification. In reality, some of them would only lose a bit of their useful life. They would not be fully used up perhaps for 30, 40 years or even more. There are others that are used up immediately, and there are others at all different intervening points. But we can't keep track of so many different periods of depreciation. So at least to get a handle on the subject, we assumed that whatever capital goods are in existence at the beginning of a year, they're all used up in that year, which means that in order to maintain the supply of capital goods, we'd have to produce an equivalent supply in that year. And so we assumed that we had an economy capable of producing at one extreme a quantity 2K of capital goods accompanied by 0C of consumers' goods, and at the other extreme a quantity 2C of consumers' goods accompanied by 0K of capital goods. And whichever we produced, or whichever intermediate combination, the original 1K that we already have, that would be used up. And we saw that at either extreme, there'd be a terrible problem if we used our capital goods simply to produce consumers' goods and didn't produce any new capital goods. What would be the supply of capital goods next year?
Zero.
And what would be our ability to produce next year?
Zero.
Yeah, virtually zero. Zero plus a few nuts and berries, perhaps, and that would be about it. We'd be reduced to the level of our caveman ancestors. Now, on the other extreme, if we did nothing but produce consumers' goods, we'd have 1 year of a party type arrangement, but then we have no capital goods, then we're back to, well, that's the case we've just discussed. If we did nothing but produce capital goods, we'd have a great supply of capital goods, but we'd die of starvation before we could get the benefit of the additional capital goods. So either total extreme would be something to be avoided. Yes, Mr. Whitesides.
Okay. Over the weekend, I decided to try out a little bit of, Wiesman economics.
Yeah.
And I, was teaching this exact lecture that we talked about last week to, some friends of ours, some very friends of ours. My problem is I'm all for productive expenditures and living lean, right?
Yeah,
you have to consume to live, right? Mm-hmm. That much is true.
Yeah.
How do you persuade the female gender?
All right, well, that's
not to consume.
That's
like
not an
economic.
That's not an economic question. An interesting question.
Well, no, because that was the problem is that the wife wanted to furnish the house, have a nice little nest or whatever, and like if it was up to guys, I'm sure we could be living in cardboard boxes or whatever, having tons of productive expenditures, like if we wanted to follow this theory, and so like I don't know, I'm just like wondering, is there what's a happy medium,
buy her what she wants.
Just keep her happy.
Yeah.
Well, that's one possible way to do it. I don't think I'm qualified to answer that.
All right. You just want to avoid that altogether?
Yeah, I think that's diplomatic to do.
All right.
But I don't think your generalization applies universally. I would imagine Martha Stewart would be saving quite heavily. And any woman who accumulates a great deal of wealth in order to do so would be having to consume, save heavily and consume modestly.
All right.
Okay. Well, now we introduced an illustration in terms of numbers, and that was Figure 14.4, and we saw here we have a series of years: year 1, 2, 3, 4, and N. Mr. Cutshaw, did you have a question?
Oh,
okay. All right. And here we are in year one. We've got one K of capital goods and one L of labor. And we're assuming they're devoted 50-50 in producing capital goods and consumers' goods. And 50% happens to be the proportion of output that you need going to capital goods in order to produce one K, in order to reproduce this one K that's used up. This one K is used up and gone, irrespective of what we produce. In order to maintain the supply of capital goods, we need to produce a fresh 1K. Now, if in the total system, if devoting 100% of our effort to capital goods would result in 2K of capital goods and 0C of consumers' goods, what proportion of our effort do we need to devote to capital goods to get that replacement 1K? 50%. 1K is 50% of 2K. I tried to make the numbers as easy as possible, so we don't have to waste brain space on complicated fractions. So here we are. 1K is used up in the course of production, but we're devoting half of our output to capital goods, so we replace it, and we devote the other half to consumers' goods. And we get 1C of consumers' goods. Next year, we have the same supply of capital goods and labor again. The same story repeats itself indefinitely. And this would be a stationary economy. In a stationary economy, the extent to which we produce new capital goods just precisely offsets the productive consumption of existing capital goods. So we have an intact supply of capital goods.
It just replaces it?
Yeah, in a stationary economy.
It just replaces what you use.
Yeah, we're producing enough to replace what we've used up. And if we have the same supply of labor, our overall ability to produce remains unchanged, and things could go on like this indefinitely. All right, but what we want to do is see what's required to get out of a stationary economy and into a progressing economy in which we'll have positive capital accumulation. Now, using the assumptions we have that the existing capital goods are all used up in the 1 year, the 1K is used up. But at the extremes, we could produce 2-0 or 0-2. In order to have capital accumulation, we need to devote more than half of our effort to producing capital goods, something more than half. Now, I picked the number 60% because that's a significantly higher percentage, and it's relatively easy to work with. And if we have 60% concentration on the production of capital goods, then we have a 40% concentration for consumers' goods. Well, where do we get these output numbers of 1.2K of capital goods and 0.8C of consumers' goods? Well, 1.2 is the number you get when you apply 60% to 2. And where do we get the 2 from? Well, we've assumed that if we devoted 100% of our effort to capital goods, we'd get 2K. So we assume 60% of our effort to capital goods is 60% of 2, 1.2. So we have now 1.2K of capital goods, but we've had to cut back on the production of consumers' goods in order to free up labor and capital goods to produce more capital goods. You can imagine General Motors produces fewer passenger automobiles, more heavy trucks and diesel locomotives. The construction industry is producing, constructing more factories and office buildings, fewer residential homes. The appliance industry is producing more equipment for business, less for consumers. So that translates into 0.8C and 1.2. But notice, in year two, we now have 1.2K of capital goods, and that is what is available with which to produce. So we'll have the 1L of labor. We assume we have an unchanged supply of labor. That 1L of labor is now aided by 1.2K of capital goods rather than 1. And here we introduce a further simplifying assumption. We assume that our total overall ability to produce is in direct simple proportion to the supply of capital goods. So now if we have 1.2K, we assume we should be able to produce at either extreme 2.4. So we should be able to produce 2.4K of capital goods in year three if we did nothing but produce capital goods along with zero consumers' goods, or alternatively 2.4C of consumers' goods along with zero of capital goods. Mr. Castillo, yes.
Are we assuming that the 1L of labor to produce the 1.2K of capital goods is due to productivity increases or technological advances to produce the 1.2 for the 1L of labor versus the prior year? Take that one same L of labor to produce the 1K.
Are we assuming that the ability to produce 1.2K here is the result of technological advances?
Well, no, I'm looking down at year two, and I look at 1.2K of capital goods.
Yeah.
Down below a little bit more, right there.
Yeah.
But I'm still using the 1L of labor.
Yeah.
1 unit of labor.
Right. We have the same labor, but it's working with the aid of more capital goods. And when you have more capital goods, that allows the same labor to produce more. It would be such things as, at an earlier stage, people are working with hand tools.
I see.
And now they have 1.2K. And some of these perhaps might be power tools. Mr. Landon. Mr. Taylor, excuse me.
Yeah. So practically speaking, then, when we're talking about a progressive economy, then in going into year two, this economy decided that we're going to take 60% of the output or the resources and focus on production of capital goods.
Right.
As opposed to
consumer goods. Right, and what would bring that about, which I didn't stress this evening, I should have perhaps introduced it already 10 minutes ago, what brings about these changes in the relative production of capital goods and consumers' goods is the relative demand. Notice here I say 1.2K of capital goods in response to a demand for capital goods of 600, and the 0.8C of consumers' goods in response to a demand for consumers' goods of 400. Now, let's just back up and notice that before, when the relative production was 50-50, that was in response to equivalent relative demands. The demand for capital goods was only 500, and the demand for consumers' goods was 500. So what has had to go on here is that between figure 14.4 and 14.5, people's savings habits have changed. Mr. Whiteside has convinced his wife to consume less and save more, and this has become a general cultural phenomenon. And so now people who had been consuming 500 have decided to consume only 400 and use that 100 to buy capital goods. They personally don't have to buy the capital goods. Maybe they put it in banks. The banks lend it to business firms who are buying capital goods. Yes, there was a question over here, Mr. Wilson.
Yeah, well, the increase in capital goods, though, is then going to be in response to, you say it's in response to the demand, but
yeah.
Could you, increase that supply of capital goods and drive the demand as well to cause the shift? I mean, what could you do to cause that shift from say, your theoretical 50-50 to that 60-40?
Well, what would drive the demand would be if people decided they were more concerned with the future. There could be a variety of things that will determine this. We had such a shift historically. If you look at our ancestors in the Dark Ages, people were very narrowly focused on just living for the day, maybe tomorrow, but there was very little thinking about the remoter future. And one of the things I'm sure that contributed to a profound change in attitudes was a fundamental change in the ideas guiding the Western world. In the Dark Ages, people were extremely mystical, didn't pay very much attention to logic and reason, and that led them to think very short range. But in the late Middle Ages, the philosophy of Aristotle got to be reintroduced into the Western world. The Catholic Church converted to Aristotelianism in the course of the 13th and 14th centuries. And this launched the foundations of science. It launched longer range thinking. It operated to reduce the degree of warfare. So how future oriented would people be if they're living in an environment of constant war? So if you succeed in bringing in a good harvest, the feudal aristocrat seizes it from you, or if he doesn't, there are Viking invaders, or there's a neighboring feudal lord who launches a war, and this is the chronic condition. How long range will people be? They'll just be concerned with the moment. So you need a pacification of the society, a growing influence of rationality. Such factors bring about a change in attitudes. And then there can be many other causes comparable, but maybe on a somewhat lesser scale. Now, yes, Mr. Sweeney.
I was noticing on the next figure, 14.5,
yeah.
That same 1L of labor that's going through each of these levels.
Yeah.
Can you flip that one?
Pardon me?
Can you flip the figure 14.5?
Okay, sure.
So in year two, that one L of labor is able to purchase 0.8C of consumer goods, and then the following year, that same one L of labor is able to purchase 0.9C of...
0.96.
So 0.96, yeah. Are you saying that the consumer goods are costing them less, or are they paying the labor more?
Okay, that's an interesting question, and I think we could give an answer based on the diagram. What are we saying about the demand for consumers' goods and the demand for capital goods from year to year in both figures?
No change.
It becomes constant. In the one case, they're both constant at 500. In this case, they're both constant at 600, 400. And now, what's happening to the physical quantities being sold, produced and sold? They're going up at a very hefty rate, 20% compound per year. Well, applying the formula we developed very early on for the consumer price level, the general consumer price level equals the amount of money expended to buy consumers' goods, which here is 400 units of money, divided by the supply. Well, what's happening to the supply each year? It's 1.2 what it was the year before. So if you have 6/5 the supply from one year to the next being sold for the same expenditure to buy it, what is implied about the price level?
Increase. 5/6.
It's 5/6. Prices would be falling 1/6 per year. That's what would be happening. Now, we haven't said anything about wages separately and explicitly, and we'll get to that hopefully later tonight. It's a more complicated situation to introduce wages, but we can see here that you'd have the same consumption. Now, a major part of consumption is going to come from the payment of wages. Most consumption comes from the payment of wages and salaries. But notice, what we're assuming here is we have the same total expenditure of money from year to year. It's always adding up to 1,000 units of money being expended. Now, that, of course, is not true in the real world. We have more and more money being expended in almost every year. But what is the foundation of that? What brings about the increase in the volume of spending from year to year? Pardon me?
More wages.
Well, what brings about the increase in total wages paid? What was
more
the
production.
First? Pardon me?
More production.
Well, here's more production.
Lower cost.
Here's lower costs.
More money,
more money. That was the first major proposition we developed in the course. The amount of money that is spent depends on the amount of money that exists. Now, implicitly here, we're assuming that there's a fixed given total quantity of money, and it's supporting a fixed given total volume of spending, 1,000 units of spending to buy newly produced goods, and that's it. The 1,000 can be divided 500, 500, 600, 400, or in different proportions, but to be able to get a handle on things, we are assuming for the time being the total volume of spending is fixed. Now, let me point out there's really no other way to go about it than this way. If we assume that everything is varying at the same time, that we assume the quantity of money is going up or down, total spending is going up or down, the increase, the supply of labor is going up or down, we have too many things to keep track of. How many of you have ever had a any kind of course in physics? Okay, when you're analyzing what determines the velocity of a sailboat or a motorboat, what sorts of things enter into being able to understand such a problem?
Resistance.
You have to analyze separate factors, and the procedure that is used is to look at separate components. There's one force vector supplied by the wind. There's another force vector possibly moving in a different direction coming from the current. If you have a powered boat, you have a third force vector coming from the boat's engines. And each one is making a separate contribution to the overall total outcome, which we view as the sum of the separate different forces. But to understand it, you have to assume that each one operates separately from the others. And we look at one at a time. And after we've looked at one at a time, we are then in a position to comprehend the combined operation. Well, one of the essential things we need to do to understand the economics is to assume the quantity of money and volume of spending are the same, to analyze things in that context. And then we're in a position to see what is the distinct contribution of an increase in the quantity of money. What difference does it bring about? What we're looking at now is how is the productivity of labor increased? How is the standard of living raised? How do we have capital accumulation? Well, the one leading way that we get it would be through a rise in demand for capital goods at the expense of the demand for consumers' goods. If the demand for capital goods goes up and the demand for consumers' goods goes down, the existing means of production will be devoted more heavily to producing capital goods and less heavily to consumers' goods. And then, if we now have a sufficient production of capital goods to surpass the capital goods that we're using up in this process, we then have a bigger supply of capital goods. And what is the advantage of that? We now have a greater overall ability to produce. The productivity of labor will be higher. And we can see this from year two on. In year two, we have 1.2K of capital goods instead of just one. and on the foundation of this 1.2 rather than 1, our overall total ability to produce is increased. And here I'm making the assumption that our ability to produce is increased in simple direct proportion to the increase in the supply of capital goods. In other words, by 20%. So the supply of products that will be available at the start of year 3 is going to be determined by an overall ability to produce not merely 2 units of output, but now 2.4 units. We have 1.2. We're assuming that for every unit K of capital goods or partial unit K, such as 0.2, that we can produce 2 units of output, whether capital goods or consumer's goods. We have a simple productivity constant for capital goods. We're assuming each unit of capital goods makes possible the production of 2 units of output, whether it's for the capital goods or consumer's goods. When we have only 1 unit of capital goods, our maximum output is 2. When we have 1.2 units of capital goods, our maximum output is 2.4. And there's a question over here. Yes, Ms. Yan.
So what you're saying right now is we need to accumulate more capital goods in order to produce more in the future. Yeah. But however, does that apply to every single industry?
Yeah.
Consulting versus automaker. Consulting use more labor as opposed to capital goods.
Well, there are different industries that have more capital goods, others have less capital goods, but I would think that more capital goods would be helpful to the productivity of labor in every industry. Even in consulting, one form that more capital goods would take would be bigger, higher powered computers, more elaborate computers, more elaborate peripherals,
so
higher speed internet connections. So if you think about it, whatever line of work you're in, is there any type of equipment that you don't presently have that would be an aid to your productivity if you had it? And I think that's true probably just about everywhere. You might find some exceptions, but there are. I think the overwhelming case is that more capital goods would help. And this is dramatically true in the less developed parts of the world. What keeps them less developed is that they have so much less capital goods. And the rate of progress in the countries that are progressing goes hand in glove with their accumulation of capital. Yes, Mr. Chairman?
I'm wondering that if one year to another, if capital goods has continued to progress and we put heavy investment into it, then is it fair to say that the following year or so, the consumer good, the price for consumer good would drop?
Yeah.
Does it have any effect to it?
Pardon me?
I mean, is there a relationship between, the price versus the...
Is there a relationship between prices and the ability to produce?
Yeah, to produce.
Yeah, very definitely. You just have to know how to look for it. Now, if you're looking for it around us in our economy today, we're calculating prices in this stuff. And you have some cases in which prices are falling, but mainly they're connected with computers, microprocessor capacity, hard drive storage space. We've had some incredible price reductions there. I may have pointed out I bought my first hard drive about 20 years ago or so, and I paid something like $2,500 for a 40 megabyte hard drive, which I thought was incredible at the time. Very recently, I bought a 250 gigabyte hard drive for about $250. So if you calculate how much I'm paying for a megabyte of hard drive space, I think the price reduction is way high in the 90% somewhere, maybe 98%. Similarly, the first computer I got had 256 kilobytes of RAM. My most recent computer has a gigabyte of RAM. And I think it cost, I remember not too many years ago, in the late 80s, I bought some extra megabytes of extended memory, I think. And I was paying about $1,000 per megabyte. Today, you can go into any store, and for a couple of $100, I think you get the 512 megabytes or gigabyte. So that's a huge drop. Now, on the other hand, if you look at, say, the cost of having your house painted, which I just looked at the other day, we had it done last in 1996, and I think we paid about $3,200. And we got a quote from the same painter now for $6,500.
Wow.
So that's quite an increase. I bought a car in 1972, I think a new Plymouth Valiant, for maybe $2,500. And 2 years ago, I bought a Honda Accord, which is roughly comparable, I suppose, for $25,000. So, and if you look at house prices, clothing prices, you pay more to have heels and soles on a pair of shoes than you used to pay in the 70s for a new pair of shoes. So most prices have risen. But nevertheless, the increase in production and supply is still at work operating to make prices fall. Prices are much lower because of the increase in production and supply than they otherwise would have been. You see, why is it that prices have risen even though we've had major increases in production and supply, and we have far more people in the economy? The labor force is substantially larger. The output per worker is almost certainly higher on average. So we do have a significantly larger total supply of products, which by itself should make prices fall. Yes, Mr. Woody?
The inflation of the money supply.
Yeah, the inflation of the money supply, the increase in the quantity of money. Let's say that over the last 25 years, the production and supply of products has doubled. I don't know the exact increase, but that's not far off the mark. All right, if there had been no increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending, and the same volume of spending had to buy a doubled output, what would have happened to prices? It would have halved. Now, if instead prices are up by double instead of down by half, what would be consistent with twice the supply being sold at twice the price? What would have to be going on in the numerator of the price level equation? The expenditure would have to be four times. If four times the money is spent to buy twice the goods, well, prices will be double. If 40 times the money were spent to buy twice the goods, prices would be 20 times higher. But notice, if we didn't have the increase in supply, if we have four times the spending with no increase in supply, what's the effect of four times the spending taken by itself? How much do prices go up on the strength of four times the spending considered in and of itself?
Four times.
So you see, we have two separate elements here. There's the increase in spending. If that's four times greater, that's operating to raise prices by a factor of four. If at the same time there's a doubling of production and supply, what is it operating to do to prices?
Double.
To have them. Now, the outcome is the result of these two separate elements. One factor is operating, in this case, to quadruple prices. The other is operating to halve them, and the outcome of the two combined is to double. Four divided by two, four times a half is two. But notice, if we look at things separately, we see one contribution from the side of money and spending, that's operating to raise prices. The other is from the side of production and supply, that's operating to lower them. And the outcome is the result of the two working side by side. But to understand it, we have to look at them separately. Yes, Mr. Richards.
People always complain about the high price of gasoline these days.
Yeah.
But do you think that gasoline has really increased that much? If you look back, you know, you were saying about the price that you paid for a car in the 1970s and the price you pay for a car today. Gasoline really doesn't seem like it's changed that much over the course of 20 years.
Well, there's a case to be made for that. I think when I got that new car, yeah. I remember I was getting gasoline at that time for about 25 cents a gallon. That was in New York City.
Yeah.
Now, where gasoline prices are higher than most other places, so maybe the price at that time in most of the country might have been 18 or 19 cents. Mm-hmm. Now, recently, I'm paying sometimes $2.50 or not far off that. So if you're comparing, making that comparison, you could say, all right, the price of gasoline hasn't risen any more than many other prices. Mm-hmm. And that's probably true. But
it seems like other things have increased a lot quicker than gasoline, really.
Well, that's true. But the improvement, in order to have improvement, what we need is prices not rising as much as our wages. We need prices rising little relative to wages, or prices falling relative to wages. You see, it would be good, okay, if our wages were the same and prices are falling, or if our wages are going up but prices aren't going up as much, that's how our real wages go up. Okay, well, let's go further with this. Here we are. I'm assuming output is in proportion to the supply of capital goods. So in year two, we have 20% more capital goods. And as a result, if we continue to devote 60% of our effort to further capital goods and 40% to consumers' goods, well, now, on this foundation of 1.2K, that means we could produce conceivably 2.4K if we did nothing but produce capital goods. And what is 60% of 2.4? 1.44. And what's 40% of 2.4? 0.96. Well, you now notice, here we are in year three, the supply of capital goods produced exceeds the supply used up. We have further capital accumulation in year three compared to year two. And now in year three, the capital goods used in production will not be merely 1.2K, but the larger total, 1.44K. And if the output per unit of capital goods remains 2, then we continue to have the ability to produce 2 units of output for every unit K of capital goods that we have. What should be our limiting ability to produce now? What would be the extremes? 2 times 1.44. Here's the supply that we have here, 1.44. If we did nothing but produce capital goods on the foundation of 1.44K, and we have 2 units of output resulting for every unit K that we use up, what should be our potential output of capital goods? 2.88. Or alternatively, no capital goods and 2.88C of consumers' goods. Well, what do we get if we continue to devote 60% and 40%? We'll have 60% of 2.88. And what is 60% of 2.88? 1.728. And 40% of 2.88 is 1.152. And then we'd be off and running still further. In every succeeding year, we'd have the output of both increasing 20% compound. Now, that's an unrealistically high rate of increase, but that is the basic idea. And notice what has finally happened to the absolute level of consumers' goods production by the time we come to year four compared with year one. It is now greater. Now we have a situation where the production both of capital goods and consumers' goods is continually rising. Even though consumers' goods represent a smaller percentage of the economy, their supply is increasing, and soon, because of that increase, the total amount of consumers' goods surpasses the original amount. You see, this first a temporary drop. We go from 1C to 0.8C, but that's because we're building up our capital structure. But then when we have more capital goods, we now have the ability to produce both more capital goods and more consumers' goods. And then with still more capital goods, the same thing goes on. And fairly soon, we can produce more consumers' goods than we could to begin with, even though we're devoting a lesser percentage. Yes, Mr. Castillo.
I would assume the contemporary economists with their views on saving and hoarding don't see this at all.
Oh, they ignore it. One shouldn't say that all ignore it, but I would say the majority.
Even with the simple math roll down.
You know, in their view, what grows the economy is the Federal Reserve printing more money. The more money is spent, and they're not looking at capital accumulation. Now, if we were looking at capital accumulation, the entire context of political debate in this country would be radically different from what it is. Right now, there may be some major changes in the offing in connection with tax policy. And the changes being aimed at are of a kind consistent with this approach. Changes that would promote saving, shift the burden of taxation away from saving and onto consumption. You see, people are paying taxes, and with different types of taxes, the taxes could be at the expense of funds they otherwise would have saved and invested, or instead at the expense of funds they would have consumed. Now, if the taxes are at the expense of funds that would otherwise have been consumed, well, the taxes impose a certain amount of pain, but they're not interfering with the ability of the economy to progress. In contrast, if the taxes are imposed on funds that would otherwise be heavily saved and invested, then they're undercutting the ability to have capital accumulation. And we're in a position to analyze that right here. Suppose here we are, we have a progressing economy, and now the government enters the picture and it starts imposing heavy taxes on funds that would otherwise be heavily saved and invested.
Like dividends or interest?
Yeah, whatever, without specifying just what yet, the government is going to collect 100 in taxes. Now, what does the government do when it collects the taxes? What will it do with the proceeds?
Pay for government program.
Okay, the funds get consumed. Either the government itself consumes them, or the government distributes funds to private individuals who consume them through various entitlement programs. All right, now, if the government imposes 100 of taxes here, if those taxes fall on saving, and because they're falling on saving, they fall on the demand for capital goods. See, let's just pause for a moment. Where does the demand for capital goods come from? What makes possible the demand for capital goods?
Saving.
It's savings. It's funds that people abstain from consuming that they're saving. Now, if the government takes away 100 of those funds and causes them to be consumed, then what happens is we're going from this arrangement of 600 demand for capital goods, 400 demand for consumers' goods, we're going back to the previous diagram, 500 and 500. And so what happens to economic progress? It's we go from progress to stagnation. If we started with the 500-500 scenario, what might have brought about this kind of change would be the government reduces the taxes that land on savings by 100, and either cuts its spending by 100, in which case you have simply a flat-out tax cut, or it shifts the taxes to fall on consumption. And that would bring us here, too. Yes, Mr. Taylor.
Can you give us a example of contrasting economies? So you've followed my question.
Yeah, okay. I would say there are major contrasts in modern economic history. The English-speaking world, starting around the middle of the 18th century on down until well in this century, was one of rapid economic progress. There was a greatly improved rate of saving, which came about because of security of property as well as people being longer range. See, one of the distinguishing characteristics of Anglo-Saxon law is the protection it affords to property rights. The government is not a threat. The government traditionally could not arbitrarily seize people's property. People didn't have to worry about their neighbors seizing their property. So what do you do if you're already thinking long range and you're in a position where you know that if you accumulate wealth, it's not going to be arbitrarily taken away from you, you'll be able to benefit from it.
Right.
How will that affect the extent to which you save? You'll save more. And there weren't significant taxes that would stand in the way. Government spending was pretty minimal. And so they had the foundation for high saving, rapid capital accumulation on that count. And then more recently, we have the examples of Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, apparently now even much of mainland China. These are areas where there are very high rates of saving and rapid economic progress. And working the other way, we have the more recent history of the United States, where we've had many developments operating to undercut the ability to save. And let's take a brief review of our tax system. We have substantial corporate income taxation. We still have a progressive personal income tax. What is the maximum federal surtax rate with today? I think with the 10% add-on in the last years of Clinton, I think it comes as high as 39.6%, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, that's at the federal level. And then in California, what is it now after this proposition passed to add an extra 1% to incomes over $1 million?
Oh, that passed.
Yeah,
that passed. So I think the maximum California rate, I think, if I'm not wrong, is 11%. So that puts you at 50% in the personal tax bracket if you're a citizen of California or most of the other states. And before you even get to personal income, there's the corporate income tax. What is the maximum corporate tax rate right now? Does anyone know?
42%.
No, it was 42% some years ago. I think it's 34%. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think 34%. So imagine there's a corporation that earns $100 and has to pay $34, and then it has $66 left. And then if that $66 is paid out as a dividend, that would be taxed, or at least until recently, for another 50%. So you'd end up with 33 cents on the initial dollar of profit. Now, I think they've reduced the taxation on dividends to a lower rate in order to avoid this double taxation. The profits are taxed first when the corporation earns them, and then they've been taxed a second time when the dividend is paid out. That has been reduced in the last few years by a special lower rate for dividends. I think that's now down to 15%. Yes, Mr. Boisseau.
How does our taxation compare to China or Taiwan or some of the other industrialized?
How does our taxation compare to some of these others?
Taxation of 56% we're just talking about.
Okay, there are many cases in which, at first glance, our taxes might appear to be lower. In some cases, I'm sure they are. But there are also many cases which, despite the appearance of being higher, where despite the appearance of others being higher, they're lower. Now, one case that may come as a big surprise is the taxation in the Scandinavian countries, the taxation on business. These are countries with horrendous overall average rates of taxation. I think in Sweden, the total tax collection may average something like 58% of people's total incomes, much worse than here. Here, it's probably on the order of about 40 or 42% of national income. But what is seldom mentioned is that in Sweden, there are some tremendous tax deductions. I believe in Sweden that every firm has the ability to, if it saves and invests half of its profit, that half is tax-free. So you might have a nominal tax rate, higher than ours. The last time I checked the figures, their nominal tax rate on corporate profits was 52%. But if you can save and reinvest up to half the profits and that pay no tax, that means the effective tax rate is 26%, which is lower than ours. And there was an article I read very recently, just within the last few weeks, in the New York Times, very much along these lines, pointing out that despite popular impression, the Scandinavian countries have a relatively favorable climate for business activity, that the taxes on business are relatively low. And this is why they are able to have these tremendous welfare state expenditures that they do, because they're financed on the backs of the average wage earner. It's not the rich capitalist pigs, in quotes, who are paying these taxes. It's the average wage earners. But the mentality that most people is, well, it's the capitalist pigs who'll pay for all this. We'll just get a free ride. Well, it's the wage earners who end up paying for it. Now, that's the only way that you can finance a welfare state without destroying the economy at the expense of the wage earners. And all of these welfare state proposals, if they're not going to destroy the economy by undercutting the demand for capital goods to the point where we can't even maintain the supply, let alone increase it, they have to be financed by taxes on wage earners, where their impact is simply to reduce the consumption of the wage earners, and the government gets their incomes and it consumes in their place. Now, if you want to avoid this god-awful taxation of the average wage earner, and you want economic progress too, you don't want to be taxing business to death, you don't want to be taxing the wage earners to death, what is the only means left to avoid both?
Reduce taxation in the welfare programs.
But reduce government spending. Reduce government spending. You see, if the government simply spent less, then its total level of taxes could be less. They could cut taxes that fall on savings without increasing anybody's taxes. They could also start cutting taxes that fall on people's consumption, too. But you'd have to have less government spending. Now, the method that's so far been followed by the present administration has been to have certain tax cuts, which, if you consider them in isolation, are working in the right direction. They're reducing the taxes that fall on saving, but they're not reducing government spending. So if the government continues to spend the same, but it's cutting certain taxes at the same time, where do they get the money?
Yeah.
Well, they can print it, or to the extent they don't print it, where do they get it?
Sell government securities.
Pardon me?
Sell government securities.
Yeah, they're selling government securities. The government is simply running at a deficit. To raise the funds, it has to sell securities. Now, when the government sells securities, where does the money come from to buy them? From the citizens. It comes from the citizens' savings. The government is taking a chunk of the citizens' savings to finance its deficit. Well, the net result of this is worse than if you hadn't cut the taxes. Why do I say that? Let's imagine the government cuts taxes by an amount we'll call 100, and the people whose taxes are cut will assume save 80. Out of the funds left in their possession. They'll save and productively expend 80. Okay, that's plus 80 for savings. But what is the government doing if it's continuing to spend the 100 and borrowing the 100 from the public? It's subtracting 100 from the pool of savings. So where are you if you are adding 80 but subtracting 100?
-20.
You're negative 20. They're reducing the supply of capital. So it would be a very different story if the government cut its spending 100 and then cut the taxes 100. Then we'd have a net gain of 80 of savings. But this way, we are more likely to have a net loss. And if they don't borrow from the public, if they don't do it this way, then the only other way they do it is by printing new and additional money. And as we'll see later in the term, that works against capital accumulation too. In a variety of ways. Just think, it's this printing of money that keeps reducing the buying power of money. And how does that affect the extent to which people save? Suppose here you are, you want to save, and you're looking forward to getting the benefit of your savings later in life, but what is every dollar that you put aside today going to be worth 20 or 30 years in the future?
Less.
Less, a lot less. So. What is the effect on the gain from saving?
The loss.
It reduces it, and so it shouldn't be a shock that in that environment people end up saving less. That's one major way that inflation leads to a reduction in the rate of saving. And we'll see there are other ways as well, maybe even more potent. Okay, but here we are. We have some understanding, hopefully, of what's required for capital accumulation. We would need a rise in the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods. That would occur if people saved more, consumed less. It would occur if the government consumed less and cut taxes to allow people to save more. That would certainly do it. Now, notice any time proposals are made to cut taxes that land on savings, and this goes to the question raised a little bit a little while ago, who is assumed to be the beneficiary of these tax cuts?
Wealthy.
Pardon me?
The wealthy.
The wealthy. Didn't you hear many denunciations in the campaign? Bush's tax cuts, the main benefit went to a very tiny percentage of high-income taxpayers.
Yeah.
Okay, now the way this is generally discussed is, that's all well and good for this handful of rich people who are already super rich, who are living quite well without that tax reduction. What benefit is it to anybody else? Well, apparently, the inference to be drawn is of no benefit to anybody else. It's just a benefit to this handful of very wealthy people. But if it's the case that the great bulk of the tax reduction will be saved and reinvested, can you see any benefits to anybody else?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, it would mean that we would have a more productive economy. We'd have a greater supply of capital goods, a greater ability to produce, a growing supply of capital goods and consumers' goods. Now, this goes perhaps even to a wider point. When people look out at big corporations and wealthy individuals in general, their fundamental attitude is, well, their wealth is all well and good for them. They do very well by it. But it's nothing to me. When people look at other people's wealth, their attitude is, the only way I'd be able to benefit from their wealth is if and when I became an owner. It's very widely believed that the only people who benefit from privately owned means of production are a small minority of capitalists. And the masses have no interest in private ownership of the means of production. That just benefits the narrow group of capitalists. But if you stop to think about it, can you think of any way in which the wealth of General Motors or Toyota is a benefit to you,
yeah.
Even without being a stockholder?
Yeah.
Without being a stockholder or a bondholder, in what way does anyone else benefit from the wealth of General Motors or Toyota or any firm?
Yeah. Because as they accumulate wealth and invest in better production, then eventually it would lower prices of products to the public.
Well, even before it lowers prices, how about right now? When people are buying automobiles, aren't they getting the benefit of the means of production that produce automobiles? Aren't we getting the benefit of the privately owned automobile factories and their machinery, etc., in the goods that we buy?
So it just enables them to continue to supply?
Yeah, that's what enables them to produce these things. Here we are. General Motors is the owner of its factories. It and its stockholders own its factories. And you and I don't own a single share of their stock. But if we buy a General Motors automobile, aren't we benefiting from their factories and their equipment?
Yes, sure.
And even if we don't buy a General Motors automobile, aren't we benefiting to some degree because of the competition that General Motors provides to whoever is producing the kind of car that we do buy? When we buy gasoline at an Exxon station, I don't think there are any in California anymore, but let's say at a Chevron station, aren't we benefiting from Chevron's oil refineries and pipelines and oil fields? See, people are looking at privately owned means of production with eyes that would be appropriate several centuries ago. If we lived in a society of self-sufficient farmers, if the privately owned means of production were used to produce for the benefit of the farm families that owned them, which was the case for most of history, if you look at a self-sufficient farm family and you ask the question, who benefits from that family's fields? Who benefits from its oxen or mules or whatever? Well, who's the beneficiary?
Yeah.
The family that's producing the things they consume. But if you're looking at a farmer's field in a modern division of labor economy, where the output is sold in the market, who's the beneficiary of the field and the animals or the tractors and whatever?
The
general consuming public. And there's a further general benefit. The privately owned means of production are the base of the demand for labor. The capital of other people is the source of the goods and services we buy as consumers and of the demand for the labor that we sell as wage earners. But this is just totally ignored. And you have an endless political discussion where there's one side that projects the attitude the benefit to the masses lies in seizing the wealth from the capitalists, or at least raising their taxes. And the other side doesn't know how to reply. That's the state of current political economic debate. Yes, Mr. Woody.
Is the second view that you just said about not giving the tax breaks and so the government has more money to spend, basically, is the reasoning that because of that, then the government can provide things that, you know, so people are better off, just in like the General Motors example, better roads, more police, more, you know.
Yeah, well, you see, the attitude is, here's General Motors that has some rich stockholders, they're doing very well, they benefit. Let's sock it to them. Let's take the money from them, and then we'll spend the money for all kinds of public purposes. Sometimes it might be roads, maybe now it'll be prescription drug benefits, it'll be sending people through college, whatever. There's no limit to the plans and projects around. Now, if we really took the money from the firms, what would be the effect in terms of this analysis? We'd have less demand for capital goods, more demand for consumers' goods. And what would be the effect on the ability of the economy to advance or even to stand pat? It would be undercut. So this would be a highly destructive policy. You can think of it in terms of eating the seed corn. You know, there's an old analogy in agriculture. You don't want to eat the seed corn because, well, you might be a little better off for the moment. You'll be starting next year. Well, the mentality of those who are constantly attacking the wealthy capitalists, their idea is, in effect, to eat the seed corn. And the only way they can avoid that is by putting the tax burden on the wage earners, which is what has happened very clearly in the Scandinavian countries. It's a myth to think that it's the wealthy who are paying for the welfare state. It's overwhelmingly the average person who's paying for it. And you can see it in your own taxes. Okay, now, yes, Mr. Weatherford?
What about the commentary by conservatives at this point in time that the wealthy individuals are paying the majority of taxes today? Is that not a true comment?
I don't think they're paying the majority. They may be paying a very disproportionate share. I think the top 1% of taxpayers may pay 25%, or maybe it's a higher percentage, of the income tax, so the personal income tax. But that's not total taxation. If you look at the Social Security tax, that's huge. That's much bigger than the corporate income tax. And the actual burden of that, half of the burden is unrecognized. Everyone is aware of, I think, 7.65% of his own salary that he pays directly. But actually, what the employer is paying for the employee, that too is at the expense of the wage earners. Because if you look at things from the perspective of the employer, does it really matter to an employer if, when he's calculating the cost of employing someone, he gives the guy so much money to take home, and he deducts 7.65% of that for Social Security, and there's a further 7.65% that he has to pay on account of that employee. Would it make any difference to the employer if he paid it to the employee?
No.
No. See, that's an extra employment cost. And that is at the expense of wages that the workers could have. All of these fringe benefits that most people think of as free, as paid by the employer, they're actually at the expense of money that they could have to take home. Okay, now let's go further with this. There are a number of points to bring out. Hopefully we see the role of saving as underlying the demand for capital goods, and that we need more saving to raise the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods, to achieve a sufficient relative production of capital goods to offset the ones being used up. There's now another dimension of the process of capital accumulation that I want to develop that's present here implicitly, and this is what you can call the productivity of the capital goods, the productivity of the capital goods. And that you should think of as the ratio of output per unit of capital goods. What is our implied productivity number here so far?
Two.
And we've developed these two diagrams on the assumption that every unit of capital goods is capable of producing two units of output, whether they're further capital goods or consumers' goods. Now, this two is not a figure, it's not a constant like the gravitational constant. It could be higher or it could be lower. Now, what would be the effects of the of this productivity number being higher? Suppose the productivity number, instead of being two, were three. And what would that imply about the proportion of output that would be needed to replace the capital goods used up? We're imagining now that one L of labor together with one K of capital goods is potentially capable of producing three units of capital goods and zero units of consumers' goods, or three units of consumers' goods and zero units of capital goods, or any intermediate combination.
Maintenance level would be about 50% higher.
Pardon me?
The maintenance level would be about 50% higher.
You're saying the maintenance proportion would be higher? What would be the new maintenance proportion? What proportion of output would we need to devote?
Would it be 1.5?
Now, you see, if we continue to devote 50% of output to capital goods,
right,
we would get 1.5K, right?
Right.
Do you all see that?
Mm-hmm.
That if at the extremes, we could produce 3003. If we continue to devote 50%, 50% of 3 is 1.5. All right, that's a correct observation. The meaning would be that now, with the same relative production of capital goods of 50%, instead of having a stationary economy, we'd have a progressing economy. We'd produce 1.5K while we used up only 1K, right? But the question that I asked was, what would be the maintenance proportion? What would be the proportion of output that would need to go to capital goods so that we would get 1K?
One-third.
You see, 1 is one-third of 3. So the maintenance proportion, instead of being 50%, would now be one-third. We could have a stationary economy devoting only one-third of our labor and capital goods to capital goods. And if we continue to devote a half, well now, instead of having a stationary economy, we'd have a progressing economy. And if we continue to devote 60%, what would be the effect?
Progressive.
We'd have a more rapidly progressing economy. So this productivity of capital goods, this is a very important element too. It's indirectly determining the maintenance proportion. And it's the higher is the productivity of capital goods, the easier is it to accumulate capital goods. The more output we can obtain from the existing labor and capital goods, the greater can be the supply of capital goods that we produce, the easier to accumulate capital goods. So this is something that is a very powerful element also in capital accumulation. There's really two main elements. There's the relative production of capital goods. That's determined by saving versus consumption, the demand for capital goods versus the demand for consumers' goods. And then there's also this factor, the productivity of capital goods. Yes, Mr. Taylor.
Would you repeat, you made an important point. Would you repeat that last point where you said the more productive we are, the easier it becomes?
Yes. The higher the productivity of capital goods, in the sense of the greater the output that we can produce relative to the same supply of capital goods, okay, the easier is it to accumulate capital goods. The easier is it to have a progressing economy. Why? Because the more output we get for the same capital goods, the smaller is the fraction of that output that we need to replace those capital goods. And any given concentration on capital goods that was previously sufficient for replacement, that will now be sufficient to have more than replacement. 50% was just sufficient for replacement before, when we could only get 2 units of output for 1 unit of capital goods. But now if we can get 3, then 50% is not just replacement, it's contributes to positive capital accumulation.
I got you. Thank you.
Okay. Now, you can understand some significant things on the basis of the role of productivity also. Is anyone familiar with the rationalizations of the old Soviet regime as to why they were never making any progress in raising the standard of living of the average person? Why they weren't able to produce more and better consumers' goods from year to year? Well, their argument always was, we're concentrating on building up heavy industry.
Defense, like defense?
Well, to some degree defense, but wider than defense. They're building up their economy. They're devoting all of their labor and capital as far as possible to building electric power plants, hydroelectric stations, steel mills. Now, this would be a reasonable excuse, maybe for 5 years or so, something like that. So if they had started in 1918 and they're shifting resources away from the production of consumers' goods into the production of heavy industry, well, after a few years, what should be their state of heavy industry? They should have more than they did when they started, significantly more. And what should that do to their overall ability to produce?
Increasing.
Okay, so by that time, we should see some recovery in the production of consumers' goods, like the way we do up here. We have an initial drop that goes from 1 to 0.8, but then as soon as we get more capital goods, the production of consumers' goods starts to recover. Well, what would we have to do in this diagram if, even though we now have 1.2K of capital goods, and a 20% larger overall ability to produce, what would have to happen in order to use this excuse that we're concentrating on capital goods so that in this year, too, we got only 0.8C of consumers' goods?
Reduction in labor.
Pardon me?
Reduction in labor.
But we still have the same quantity of labor.
Okay.
What would be required so that even though now we have a 20% larger overall ability to produce, we still produce the same limited 0.8C of consumers.
Technology, lack of technology,
efficiency. Well, that's a further part of the answer. But what would be, in order to explain this on the basis of we're concentrating on capital goods, what would be implied about the degree of such concentration?
It would be more of a percentage.
More of a percentage. You see, if when this happened, we cut the relative production of capital goods below 40%, I don't know what percentage would be to give you still 0.8. 0.8 is, I think, 5/6 of 0.96. So if we cut the relative production of consumers' goods to 5/6 of 40%, brought it down to the low 30s, and raised the concentration on capital goods somewhere up to the higher 60s, well, that could explain why the production of consumers' goods stayed down. But then the year after that, or the next 5 years after that, what should be happening?
Increasing capital.
We should have a more rapid rate of progress now. And if the production of consumers' goods still doesn't improve, and it's because we're still concentrating on heavy industry, what's applied again?
The government is keeping the difference.
Well, they have a still greater concentration on heavy industry. well, what kind of concentration on heavy industry would you need to find for after 40 years of this, or 60 years? Long ago, if that were the reason, if the concentration on building up the industry were the real explanation, then long, long ago, they should have been devoting 99 and 44/100% of their resources to capital goods. They would have been purer in capital goods than ivory snow is in soap. And the Soviet Union should long ago have been one enormous factory from Leningrad to Vladivostok. But they weren't. And it turned out that when they wanted to have any major construction project later in their regime, I think their last grand construction project was the Kama River Truck Factory, a pretty large-scale undertaking. But they didn't have the means of constructing it. They had to call in the Italians to construct the Kama River Truck Factory. Practically everything they were doing was financed by Western capital. They built a major pipeline to deliver natural gas to Western Europe. That was financed by German firms with guarantees from the German government. So here they are. They claim they're concentrating on capital all the time. But where's the capital goods to show for it? Well, you could say to some extent they didn't have the capital goods because they were also concentrating heavily on building up their military establishment. But I think there's a further element that's simply part of their consumption. I think there's a further explanation to explain why, no matter how great their concentration on capital goods might have been, they could never get very far in actual capital accumulation. And can anyone guess what that factor would be that would explain why, even with the highest concentration on capital goods, they would not be able to accumulate very many capital goods?
No demand for
technology.
The productivity of capital goods. They had a horrendously low productivity of capital goods. Now, why did they have a horrendously low productivity of capital goods? Because they had a horrendously inefficient economic system. They had an economy chronically characterized by shortages of all sorts of things. In consumers' goods, it would be practically a joke. At one time, there'd be no toilet paper available. Then you might have a sudden flood of toilet paper, but there's no soap. Or there's toothpaste, but no shaving cream, or whatever. And now, apply that in the realm of production. Just think of how many different elements are required in a modern economy for production to proceed. Imagine how you're trying to build a number of tract homes. All right, suppose you have all the necessary lumber, you have the services of the different types of labor, you've got everything. The only thing you're missing is the right nails. Okay, you've got the nails, and now you're missing the screws. Or it's always something. There can be all sorts of things, the absence of any one of which throws a wrench into the whole process. And their economy was characterized by such things as they would build hydroelectric stations and then not have the generators. Or they'd have tractors, but the gasoline would corrode the engines. Or they'd have the tractors and they wouldn't have the spare parts. They had constant gross disproportionalities because their system was essentially an unplanned economic chaos. Now, if you have such an arrangement, what does that do to the productivity of capital goods?
Drastically reduced.
It's drastically reduced, which means that you need a huge concentration on capital goods just to stand pat. And the only era in which they actually had some capital accumulation was in the era of Stalin, when they produced so little consumers' goods that they had mass starvation, when several tens of millions of people died of starvation. And so you need a concentration on capital goods to the point where they don't produce enough consumers' goods even to keep their population alive. Then they accumulated some capital goods. In effect, they converted flesh and blood into some extra factories. But then they couldn't maintain the factories. A huge proportion of whatever capital goods they produced are sitting rusting. An example, this isn't really capital goods, but they produced a considerable naval fleet. Much of it is rusting in Vladivostok. And they have all kinds of rusting factories. They have factories that are largely useless, and this is true throughout Eastern Europe. They produce things that weren't worth producing. So a system which is profoundly inefficient is not in a position to accumulate capital goods. Yes?
Is there any relationship to what you just described as far as the space program goes? Because I'm thinking if they have all these challenges with capital goods, how did we, or why did we bring them into the space program to get them up there? Because I would think that that would then increase their economy, because now they're out there building spaceships and adding to that part, and just like, where did they come into this from? Because I haven't kept up on that. Is there any relationship to that at all?
Well, their economy, I think, now is quite a bit different. I don't think.
But it would have taken a long time for that to happen, and you know, we're sending our people over there, and they're coming over here.
I think this is a political diplomatic move. That we want some measure of friendship with the new Russian government, and so it's for political show purposes. Okay. I don't think it will make very much difference to their economy.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chung.
I try to understand what you just said is that in Russia, is that reason that they spend so much time or effort or investment in capital goods and still the economy was still sluggish at that time? Is it because that it wasn't proportionally divided, rather that they concentrate on one sector rather than divided?
Well, you see, their basic problem derives from the fact that they were a socialist economy. And now, most people think that socialism means economic planning. They think socialism is a synonym for economic planning. And at the same time, people are prone to describe capitalism as an anarchy of production. These are Marxist epithets, anarchy of production. But the reality is the exact opposite. A capitalist economy is, in fact, a very, very highly planned economy, a very, very highly coordinated, integrated economy. But the planning is done by people who are conventionally ignored. All of the private businessmen and private individual wage earners and consumers. You see, people think that the verb planning goes with the entity government. You know, like to slither goes with reptiles, fish swim, birds fly, government plans. That's how people are thinking of it. The joke is a socialist government can't plan. And the reason they can't plan is because you would need the only entity who might conceivably plan would be an omniscient deity. If you have an omniscient deity that sees every sparrow on every leaf or whatever, and it can hold all of this in its consciousness, that's what it would take to plan the economy of a country. Imagine that you want to deal with the problem, should we produce more shoes? Should we produce more shoes in Minsk or in Pinsk? Should we produce more shoes using leather or canvas or other materials? Well, just think what you get involved in if you're planning this as part of a general economy-wide plan. If we produce more shoes using leather, where do we get the additional leather from? Are we taking the leather from alternative uses? If so, what uses? What alternatives do those other uses have? If we take leather away from belting for industrial machinery. Do we close those factories, or do they have substitutes to resort to? If we look at substitutes, where do we get them from? If we produce more leather, where do we get the labor and other things that we need? What do we take them away from? See, the problem, if you're attempting to run a socialist economy, is that you have to be able to hold every facet of the economy in mind at the same time and be able to determine what are the effects of making a change anywhere on the entire rest of the economic system. And nobody is remotely capable of doing such a thing. In a capitalist economy, we don't have to do that. We don't do that. But in a capitalist economy, we do have enormous, delimited, partial planning carried on by all the different firms and individuals. Just think, the firms that you're working for, do they have any kinds of plans?
Yes.
Sure.
What would be examples?
Strategic plan.
They might be planning, are any of the firms planning to introduce new products in the coming year?
Yeah.
Or to withdraw some of their present products?
Yeah.
Or redesign them? Are any firms planning to open new branches or close existing branches? To accumulate inventory or reduce their inventory? To hire new workers or fire present workers? To keep their methods of production the same or to change them? There's all kinds of things that business firms are routinely making plans about, but which are almost entirely ignored in the press and by most economists who are unaware of such major issues. But the business firms are planning, and on what basis are they making their plans? On the basis of profit and loss calculations, they're making their plans in the light of anticipated money revenues, which rest on the prices of what they're selling, and also on the basis of costs, which rest on the prices of what they have to buy. So there is planning, that's one huge point. There's planning. The planning rests on a foundation of prices. The next thing to realize is that because all the planning is based on prices, that's what serves to harmonize, coordinate, and integrate all of the different partial plans. We don't plan in isolation, we look at prices. But what the prices are reflecting are the plans of everybody else in the economy. Let me give you some simple examples. If you had gone to a liberal arts college, which I assume most of you didn't, but if you went to such a place, you might have known people in your freshman or sophomore year who are planning to go into rather esoteric majors, like maybe being a shepherd. Maybe that's too extreme. or a medieval French literature expert, or something of that kind. Now, perhaps, hopefully, by the time of their junior year, they wake up and realize if they persist in that path, they can expect to spend their lives living in a garret somewhere near starvation. And so possibly around that time, they change their majors. And maybe they go into accounting or marketing or something where they'll have a better income. Now, if we look deeper and look at the question, why would you be starving as a French literature expert, but you'll probably make out all right in accounting or marketing? Well, it's the demand, but what this integrates with is the plans of other people. Very few people have plans of their own of a kind which require the cooperation of French literature experts. But there are many, many more people who have plans that do require the services of people in accounting and marketing. So when a student changes his major based on a consideration of the income he can make, without his being aware of it, he's changing his plan on the basis of making it dovetail better with the plans of other people. He's harmonizing, coordinating his plan with the plans of others. Yes, Mr. Richard.
Is there an argument for a liberal arts education being good if you're going to go to law school? Because it gives you a good background in like history or something to be a lawyer?
I don't mean to attack liberal arts education.
No, I'm just saying.
It can be valuable, and hopefully I would think that people should at least have 2 years of liberal arts education before specializing in anything.
Liberal arts and then go and do an MBA, so you've got kind of the balance.
Yeah, that's fine too.
Yeah.
But I'm just making the point that people change their career plans, they change their housing plans, business changes its production plans, all based on considerations of profit and loss, which mean they're gearing their plans to the plans of those with whom they're dealing. Imagine we have something coming from some province in China that up to now has been largely isolated, but now there are some new highways built, and this province starts producing substantial quantities of soybeans. Well, that's going to affect the world price of soybeans. How will that affect the plans of American farmers in places like Illinois and Iowa, where they grow soybeans? Well, if soybeans are now cheaper, that means they're earning less income, and that means they have to replan what they're doing. They have to change their plans Maybe they can find out how to grow their soybeans at lower costs. In that case, they can stay in operation. Or maybe they have to change their plan and produce some other crop. Or maybe they have to get out of agriculture altogether. They have to engage in a process of replanting. We've had, in the last couple of years, many, many people have switched to low-carb diets. And this has resulted in a great increase in the demand for food with low carbohydrates. Well, this is a new nutrition plan on the part of many consumers. And how does that affect the plans of many firms producing things for grocery stores? They say we have to come out with some low carb product, and they have to do the planning to do that. And then their suppliers have to adjust their plans to provide the goods. So you have extensive replanning going on throughout the whole economy in response to changes in prices and costs. Well, in a socialist economy, you don't have this. You don't have a price system. It takes some government bureaucrats who can't remotely comprehend all the details of the economy. They're making decisions in the blind. And so that's why the economy is so inefficient and they can't accumulate capital except at the price of mass starvation. Now, there are further points in here that I want to develop. I've been assuming here that the output is directly proportional to the supply of capital goods. So every time we have more capital goods, we have a proportional increase in output. Does anyone know what major economic law, at least on the face of it, I appear to be contradicting? Pardon me?
Are you going to diminishing marginal returns?
The law of diminishing returns. What does the law of diminishing returns say that I appear to be in contradiction with?
Well, at some point, your investment doesn't yield as much as it does earlier on.
Well, does anyone know what the law of diminishing returns actually says? Well, that's an implication of it.
You don't eat more toothpaste.
What?
Some consumer goods really doesn't. It's not necessary to actually increase them.
Well, no, that's not the law of diminishing returns.
That's when you, as you consume more and more and more, you lost your...
I think you and Mr. Castillo are thinking more of the law of diminishing marginal utility. Now, diminishing returns is a law that applies to physical outputs, and what it says is that if we hold one factor of production constant and merely increase the quantity of the other one or more complementary factors of production, that sooner or later the additional returns will be less than proportional to the additional input. The classic illustration of diminishing returns was with labor applied to land. You could have a given size farm. If you apply 1 man-year of labor to, say, a 100-acre farm, you get a certain output. If you apply 2 man-years, you'll almost certainly get more output. You might even get more than twice the output. But there's going to come a point where, as you apply additional man-years of output, the additional output, additional man-years of labor, the additional output will be less than proportional, which is why we need additional land. Now, diminishing returns, if we applied it here, it would seem to imply that if we have 1L and 1K, and then we have 1.2K and 1L, pretty soon we should not expect to be able to increase output in proportion to the additional capital goods. To try to put in an illustration of diminishing returns in our context, it would seem to imply that, okay, we have 20% more capital goods, and now maybe we'll have 15% more output. And then if we have 15% more capital goods, well, now maybe we'll have 10% more output. If that were true, what would be implied about where we would end up in terms of further capital accumulation?
More capital, less output.
Pardon me?
More capital, less output.
And less output.
Well, what's happening to the size of the increases in output? If each time we increase the supply of capital goods, we get a lesser percentage increase in output.
Where would probably reduce the amount of capital you want to spend because of the marginal gains.
Well, then we'd have a lesser proportion, too. But the implication is that the process of capital accumulation would peter out.
Right.
They have a 20% initial increase, then a second increase of 15%, then 10, 5, 2, 1, to 0. Now, I'm assuming that the process of capital accumulation continues undiminished. And I think there's a way to reconcile that with the operation of the law of diminishing returns. And the reconciliation is that the law of diminishing returns assumes a given state of technology. It assumes that the state of technology is unchanged. We can have constant returns to capital goods, or even for a time, or an increase in returns to capital goods, provided we have something else, and that would be technological progress. In order to maintain the returns to the increases in the supply of capital goods, we would need technological progress. And so that is something we need to introduce as a further assumption. Technological progress is something that operates to maintain the productivity of capital goods. Its effect is positive on the productivity of capital goods. With technological progress, other things being equal, we should be able to produce more per unit of capital goods than we could otherwise. It's something that is operating positively on the productivity of capital goods. Yes, last question before a break.
So I'm sorry, so are you, with that being said, are you saying that we are assuming technological progress?
In order for this to continue, there would have to be technological progress at some point. Now let me point out immediately, though, that countries, backward third world countries that get on a path to economic progress, they can continue that for some time without new technological progress. Because just think, many of these countries start several centuries behind us. And in these intervening centuries, there's been a tremendous amount of technological progress. And that's all there waiting. Well, as these countries increase their supply of capital goods, that puts them in a position to take advantage of already existing technologies, which they previously lacked the capital goods to execute. So they can have rapid progress for a considerable time without fresh inventions being made anywhere else in the world, and this can go on until they've caught up to the modern world. For the modern world to continue to progress, we need, or quickly need, further technological progress. We don't need it immediately, but we do need it fairly soon to keep the process going. Can I ask you to hold this and raise it when we come back?
Yes.
Okay, let's take a break, and then we'll pick this up in 25 minutes.